Hello, recursive community, and welcome back to the Recursive Podcast. Our next guest is on the path of transforming how the world moves goods. Sweden Rangiov is a co-founder and the CEO of the first cargo drone airline in the world, Dronamics, a company that he co-founded with his brother Konstantin in 2014. Sweden is passionate about socio-economic impact of fast, affordable, and green freight. Dronamics develops and operates large, long-range drones built specifically for cargo. Their technology enables same-day shipping over very long distances for a variety of industries, from pharma to food, from e-commerce to spare parts. Their flagship drone, the Black Swan, recently had its first test flight. Sweden, I'm very happy that you're here. It's been long due that you join us in the podcast.
No, thank you. Thank you, Irina. It's been a pleasure.
Looking back, it's been almost 9 years now.
Yeah.
Since you started the entrepreneurial journey with Dronamics and built the first world cargo drone airline. And recently you completed your first test flight. I think we all waited exactly for this moment. How would you describe almost a decade in one sentence?
Eventful. In one word. It certainly has been the best decade for us so far. And we hope for this to have been the worst of any next decades to come. But really, you're very right. The maiden flight was a huge milestone for us. You remember we had these big beards. We had promised not to shave until that moment. It was a moment we were all very much looking forward to.
I have to say that you already made me proud in 2014. I was at the Pioneers Festival where you received the award. And back then I was still living in Austria. And I remember how happy I was and proud I was to see a Bulgarian company actually winning the competition back then.
Yeah, it was absolutely great winning Pioneers. We actually didn't go there to win. But that's a funny story for another time. But it was certainly one of the first moments where we saw so much validation, because even to get to the final and win meant that we had through a number of jury rounds from really prominent investors and so on. So it was a huge validation on our direction and carried us for a long time after that.
How did you personally change, maybe you and also your brother, over the past 9 years?
Well, we certainly learned a lot, but that was the plan. We're raised in a family of a teacher and a journalist, so we were always of the mind that, you know, you can achieve anything with knowledge. Therefore, knowledge is one of the best things you can spend your time and resource acquiring.
That's your capital.
It is, yeah. And it is also helpful that we had somewhat of an outsider's view to the industry. Yes, my brother is an aerospace engineer, but my background was in economics. So we had not built an airplane before, right? That was a challenge because to gain people's credibility. And yet, possibly because of that, we were able to see or question a lot of the dogmas in how manufacturing was done or design was done. Because when you step back and see, you'd realize that actually for more than 100 years, people have always designed aircraft to have humans on board. Even almost all aircraft have been actually not just with humans on board as a crew, but also they were always passenger driven first. Cargo was always an afterthought. So all the sizing of the fuselage was always driven by the passenger airlines who would go to Boeing, they would go to Airbus, and they'll tell them, hey, can you make an aircraft to seat like a few more people side by side? So I needed this size and so on. Where cargo is a much different product, especially nowadays with e-commerce, everything is packaged separately, everything is bulky. It's not necessarily super efficient, but that's how it is. And as a result, in the past 10 plus years, there's been a tremendous shift towards, for example, volumetric payloads. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that, let's say your airplane can take can lift 20 tons by specification, how it's designed. Okay. But you cannot fit more than 12 tons of boxes. You can fit the 20 tons with the passengers and their luggage and so on, but that's a different profile. It's a different density. Okay. So what ends up happening is that you have these super complex, super expensive aircraft, the most expensive vehicles in the world, right? And yet you underutilize them simply because they were designed not for your job. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that, you know, we were able to see even back then. And by realizing that once you remove the cockpit, it's not about saving money and so on. We have pilots. Actually, our pilots are professionally, commercially trained pilots with thousands of hours of operating experience. So we're not, it's not, oh, let's save the cost of the pilots. It's not that like that at all. But when you separate the crew from the vehicle, you actually first can size the vehicle as large or as small as you like, okay. And therefore achieve an optimum for your mission. And second, you get to be able to, you know, to do rotations or flights in a point-to-point direction, a lot more like moving chess pieces on a board. Whenever you have humans on board, you cannot do that. Like, we need to sleep, we need, you know, to rest, to... It's a completely different setup when the cockpit is in the air, mm-hmm. versus when the cockpit is on the ground. So I think not being from the industry directly helped us in that regard. And of course, not everything you question you need to disrupt, right? There's also a very solid reason why, you know, aviation is the safest mode of travel. It's because of all this learning that has been accumulated throughout the years. But if you find enough of those things to change, mm-hmm. without jeopardizing safety, you can still arrive at a product that is, you know, like in our case, 80% faster, 60% greener, mm-hmm. and 50% or more cheaper. So, wow. so that's in an industry where margins are razor thin, if they exist, and you know, it's notorious how difficult it is to have an airline that is running profitably, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So that kind of shows the value of knowledge. Yeah. If we didn't have that hunger for that knowledge, we would have not arrived here.
I guess knowledge, but also in a way the outsider perspective that you had, that you could question how things are done. One of my favorite sayings is, you know, everyone said it's impossible. One didn't believe that and he did it. So I think this pretty much describes also your story. I think over the years you received also a lot of no's and a lot of, call us when the drone is flying, when you're in the air. What did that teach you about dealing with rejection and, feeling maybe a bit of a disadvantage coming from a country that is not huge in mechanical engineering or aerospace or anything which is connected to deep tech?
Well, we were... So it comes back to, again, our hunger for knowledge. Mm-hmm. A person's opinion is not necessarily knowledge. A single person's opinion, right? So you have to ask, you know, why, multiple times, mm-hmm. you know, the five whys principle and so on. Essentially, first principles thinking teaches you the same thing. We started from a few, you know, what we believe to be immutable truths. First, when we started, there were no drone regulations, or there was a patchwork of them, or, you know, countries weren't really sure. But aviation has, you know, very harmonized. It's one of the few areas where the rules are the same in, you know, 200 countries. It's quite amazing, right?
Wow, yeah.
When you think about it. So we believe that, okay, drones, will there be more drones in the future or less? Yes, there will be. So would the regulators then want to treat drones in a harmonized way? Yes, they would. So it's just a matter of time. And then would they craft completely new set of regulations starting from zero? Mm-hmm. Or would they look to adapt as much as possible the current aviation regulations that have proven over decades, you know, to establish, you know, the best level of safety and so on? Well, obviously, they would use them as a very solid foundation and only make very few tweaks. Mm-hmm. So the fact that there may be somebody out there with a different opinion doesn't mean much to us. No offense to that person. They may be super smart and so on. But there are things that are logical and that make sense, that as long as they stay the same, there is no reason for us to change our attitude or opinion and so on. We're very open to adapting once the circumstances or the fundamentals change, mm-hmm. right? But that's been part of what's kept us so strong and going throughout the years, because we believe the laws of physics are the same everywhere. It's the laws of humans that differ and mm-hmm. that change. Mm-hmm. You cannot change gravity, but you can change a law, right? Maybe not you, but it can get changed because of market forces, because of social need and so on. So therefore, okay, we started with that approach. Let's design the aircraft as if it was a piloted aircraft. So we designed under the same kind of Part 23 or CS 23, depending on, it's essentially the regulation for designing an aircraft that's like a two-seater aircraft, mm-hmm. four-seater aircraft, general aviation, so-called. So, you know, that's what made sense to us. And, you know, years later, the regulations, that's where they're going to, right? The other thesis was, okay, will there be more online shopping or less in the future? Well, that's obvious. There will be more.
We didn't even need a lot here.
We didn't even need the pandemic to show us, but yeah. Like, think of, you know, there will be new generations of people and so on. You get used to a certain way, and will shipping be faster or slower in the future? It will be faster. Will people like to pay more money or less for shipping? Obviously less. Mm-hmm. Like Jeff Bezos has been teaching the world for like 30 years that shipping should be free. It can never be free because you're moving atoms, you're spending energy, but somehow you need to get as low as possible in your cost. So we realized, okay, if we design an aircraft that can fit those requirements, then there will be a huge market for mm-hmm. that, right? And when we speak to customers, it's super obvious. We have yet to meet a customer that says, no, this would never work, right? Okay. In fact, we're very supply constrained. We have a huge pipeline in a number of markets, and that's with a very limited kind of effort. We don't have, you know, 100 people, sales force, and so on. It's a very small team. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of travel too, but we're just scratching the surface. So the fact that somebody out there may say, in other words, I don't believe you're the team, or I don't believe that you can get there, mm-hmm. or I don't believe you have the right strategy, to me it means nothing, because I am the man in the arena. My brother is the man in the arena. Our team are the men in the arena. Mm-hmm. And not that person, right? So therefore, mm-hmm. We live in a free world. We have consciously made the choice to believe that we are those people, and we're going to keep betting on ourselves and make it happen. And where are we now? The year is 2023. We received our license last year. We were the first company to receive such a license for such a big drone, mm-hmm. worldwide, right? A year later, we remain the only company, despite so many other companies having, you know, raised 50 times more than we have to get to this phase. And they have like no clear path to regulations, or it's always changing and so on, because of all the other types of decisions that they've made and so on and so forth. And that's fine. Like I said, free world, they made their decisions, we've made ours. But it seems that our bet seems to be playing off. We have insane product market fit. We are the first and only to have a license. It's a completely new design. It looks very conventional to the untrained eye, but you don't get to 50% cost savings or others with a conventional design. There's actually a lot of things under the hood that make it so. And, you know, it's a completely new design. We didn't just put an autopilot on a Cessna on something that already exists. We started from completely blank sheet of paper, and it's not something we stole or copied or so on. We made it happen. Without us, this wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. So that's why, I mean, we knew that we had the confidence that because of those fundamentals and because we knew that we would stop at nothing to achieve that, the fact that investor number 300 may think otherwise means nothing to us because he has no skin in the game. We do. And that's why, you know, back in 2018 or 2019, my CRM, like my spreadsheet, you know, every founder has one where, you know, all the people I've met, contacts, feedback, and so on. When I reached like line number 700, I kind of gave up on that spreadsheet, right? Because by then we had, more than 680 no's and maybe only 20 yeses. And to date, I mean, again, where we are, we have funding from literally hundreds of angel investors because a lot of what we do feels contrarian, but also makes sense. And it really relies on the people and the vision and the execution. Something that, especially in hardware and deep tech, mm-hmm. a former founder can see a lot better. So that's why, yes, very early on we learned that it doesn't matter what the other people do or say. It matters what you do because you're the one who can influence.
Who's in the field and who is actually fighting all the demons. Still, I think it's an amazing story of grit and confidence. I think, you know, after the 400th investor who is saying no to you at some point, I personally would start doubting even my own vision. And I'm sure that maybe at this point you've been through that. But, you know, the set of thinking that you just described is very much true. You know, there is also the saying that when you're in your truth, then it doesn't matter what other people are saying because you're living, you know, your essence. So I think in some way you found it for yourself, you and your brother. And at the same time, both of you are actually first-time founders. This is very improbable, you know, to build a successful company, especially which is that difficult from the first time.
In technology, yes. But actually... I had started a few businesses before,
okay,
but in the real world. So,
the real world.
not in the world of bits, but in the world of atoms. Mm-hmm. And I had learned quite a bit through them, through, you know, their success and failures.
Mm-hmm. When you started Genomics, that was soon after Amazon actually announced their plans for delivery drones. And yet, 10 years later, we're still not receiving our pizza via drone. I think Amazon made around 100 deliveries in 10 years. I know that it's a different type of delivery, but still, what do you think is the reason that we're lagging behind? And how do you think that we're still going to move forward? Is it the assumptions that you made are actually correct, but still it's not something which is democratized, that we're not receiving deliveries in this way of transport?
Yeah. So first of all, I have tremendous admiration for everyone who's, you know, out there in the arena trying to change the world in a way that they're convinced that we'll make it a better place. Right? So definitely super supportive of Amazon and all their efforts and everyone else who's tried and keeps trying. What I believe... Again, and the reason why when we started, we could have just said, we had just seen the Amazon showcase on 60 Minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we could have just said, hey, let's, you know, build a drone ourselves, the same drone, and just do it here in Bulgaria, because we know oftentimes technology first may originate in the US, but then it takes a few years to trickle down. And you've seen it like with Rocket Internet and so mm-hmm. on. It's a very well-trodden path to just copy whatever comes out of the Americans or other markets, right? And deploy it here and wait to be acquired or not.
Yeah.
So But first, that was not interesting for us. And second, you know, this as a model, like copying, spending your life copying something, it's just not, yeah. We think it's too easy, right?
And you it's don't an, like it easy.
No, and it's, well, yeah, because it's
okay.
It's more, when something is harder, it's more rewarding for us. But again, whoever wants to copy, that's their life, their choice. But the second reason was we saw kind of like a lot of challenges. So in a way, maybe we were the critics to those men in the arena, per Roosevelt, because we saw, okay, you have a flying object, gravity is really tough to overcome, right? And so the smaller you are, if, for example, like the more susceptible you are to weather, wind, and so on, like you're just less of a mass, less momentum, then your vertical takeoff, so you need to have propellers. You don't generate lift any other way than just constantly spending energy. The way, the reason why we fly in airplanes and not in helicopters, you know, by wide margin, when you go to the US, you don't go to on a helicopter from Europe, is because the wings generate lift themselves, and you don't need to spend additional, like as much energy to fly, to move forward.
Okay.
And so it's so complex to, you know, to fight gravity and to be there, that you really should optimize for anything that you can. So when it comes to cargo or moving goods, we naturally felt, okay, verticality helps in urban environments for sure, because not everyone has an airport in the backyard.
Yeah.
But is that really the problem? Yes, in a lot of urban environments, the last mile is a challenge, but it's also, you know, outside of the US and maybe London, you know, in second and third world locations, they would, you know, the last mile is a huge source of employment. So if your value proposition is, hey, I'm just going to bring a bunch of small plastic electronics to replace human labor in a country where already the unemployment is like 30%, it's a political non-starter to begin with, right? And then on the technology side, again, you're small. So if the regulator comes and says, what you're doing is great, but I need you to make it like an order of magnitude safer, so you need to put these 10 kilograms of extra equipment and put additional redundancies and so on, then your machine that was meant to carry a kilo, you know, 10 kilograms on a, even on a 20 kilogram machine, 10 extra kilograms means the math doesn't work. It doesn't take off. So that's why you see even now how big those drones are that deliver coffee and so on, like comparatively. And yes, there is a point at which they will, the economies of scale could push it into, you know, economic viability and safety and so on. And there's not just Amazon, but other companies that are to different degrees of success doing it. So we're not skeptics, but we saw back then in 2014 that we, if we were to start a company, it would take an extraordinary amount of capital and knowledge and so on to get this challenge right. Because it's a challenge of ultimately small plastic electronics at scale. And who is the best in the world? China. If you in confirmation to our thesis, perhaps people don't really realize it, but DJI, you know, the Chinese drone brand, they have more than, I mean, 60 or 70% market share worldwide of drones, of recreational drones. And it's, if you think about it, that's the only consumer category in the world where you have a single brand with such a extraordinary market share.
Wow.
There is no other thing, not iPhones, no cars, no nothing. Everything else is like, this feels like there was a winner takes all market and DJI took it. There were so many companies that tried in the meantime. And the only way now DJI is kind of eroding their advantage is through regulatory. Oh, some people don't trust them because of where they're from and so on.
Yeah.
So, but on putting that geopolitical angle aside, the actual economics and the actual, you know, technology and so on is all in their favor, right? So when you have two kids out of Bulgaria thinking of like where the world, where they believe the world is going, that's why we felt that this challenge would be a, you know, a much higher challenge than if we just create an airplane, as absurd as it sounds. So we went ahead and decided to focus on the airplane. In fact, also the other big reason was that solving urban connectivity was not interesting for us. Why? Because again, you can do last mile with humans very successfully, same day. I was even that same year, I was in India, my cell phone broke. My Airbnb host told me there's this wonderful website called Flipkart. I went on it. I could pay an extra $1 to get it, you know, it was in the evening, to get it the next day. So essentially it's just de facto same day. And that's because the inventory was already in New Delhi, right? And the guy was there with a motorbike, even like texted the hosts 5 minutes before knocking out. That was 2014. We didn't have next day or same day in Bulgaria even at the time.
Yeah.
So the challenge, however, in a country like India is not so much inside. You can find the labor, you can find the system, you can do it. What is more difficult there is between cities. Same as, you know, even in Eastern Europe, parts of Western Europe and so on. So 90% of the world and where the world is going to in terms of population projections and so on, actually does not have so much the pain point of last mile delivery as they do have the pain point of middle mile delivery happening in a fast and economical way. So that's why we were so much more excited that, you know, instead of spending so much more time on a problem that we don't believe exists, to spend it on a problem that we are absolutely certain that exists.
Well, still, can you walk me through also the business model? Why not just build drones? Why do you decide to do an airline? How does it make sense?
Well,
because you're actually tackling the, another issue on top of it. I mean, it's already hard enough to build a drone. Now you want to build also the commercial airline that is going to operate these drones.
Well, first of all, pure manufacturing is a race to the bottom. Ultimately, there will be somebody out there who's, you know, hungrier than us, you know, more outsider than us, willing to grow a longer beard than us. And they can do that. And they can do something that can be faster, cheaper, better, and so on as a piece of hardware. But it's the customers that really matter. So when we spoke to customers about this, they would uniformly say, this is amazing, but if my truck breaks down, I can fix it in any village. Right, I can find a mechanic everywhere. If I buy this and it breaks down, like, what do I do? Do you guys have the presence? Do you like the support network and so on established and so on? So when you start thinking, aha, okay, maybe then I have to have the mechanics trained. I have to have all this. So then it's a natural extension. Well, does the customer want to buy a vehicle or does the customer truly want atoms to be moved? And if it's atoms to be moved, why don't we just offer the service since we're going to have to do all these other things anyway? Right. And also this has the benefit of, you know, it's new technology. It's as amazing the Black Swan version one is, it is version one with more operations, with more learnings, with more people, with more capital and so on. You arrive at better versions, faster versions, cheaper versions and so on. So it pays to have the R&D and operations under the same roof so that you get to shorten the feedback loop as much as possible.
That's true. Okay.
And then there's the, I guess, where that thesis really well, really played out well, was with the EU regulations. So actually,
it was another huge milestone actually for you.
Yeah, but if you notice that, so 2007, 7 years before we started, ICAO, which is the International Civil Aviation Organization, essentially the UN body that's where all the civil aviation authorities interact and set the agenda and coordinate on rules, rulemaking, and so on. So they set up this working group, or maybe it was just an part of the membership of ICAO, but it was 63 countries to date that are part of this entity called JAROS, Joint Authority for Rulemaking and Amend Systems.
Okay.
Right. So even back then, 2007, 7 years before we started, 7 years before Jeff Bezos went on 60 Minutes, 7 years before drones were a thing, the regulators saw where the world is moving towards. And they've been working on this set of rules. And I think somewhere along the line, they realized that because all these things that help us, that help all the other innovators, which are, again, a set of trends that have not changed, cost of, you know, composite materials, so we can make all the crazy shapes in really lightweight way. Cost of carbon fiber has gone down tremendously. You know, the software capability to model and do simulations and so on has dramatically increased. Components have shrunk tremendously. That's why drones exist. There were remotely piloted aircraft for decades.
Yeah.
But drones became a thing when you can put the same components you have in your cell phone in your pocket,
mm-hmm.
because the GPS became a few grams and a few dollars worth. And now you could put it on a small flying thing. So all these trends converged. And I think they at some point saw where this is going, and that there will be this Cambrian explosion of innovation and folks trying to get it right. And as a result, the traditional type certification process may not have been the best fit. So in the old world, in the traditional manned aviation, the way to create new aircraft is you design an aircraft, and then you embark on a multi-year type certification process where you prove the safety and so on in a very structured way. And again, it's been proven by the decades and it's quite safe and so on. But that's also because the business model back then was you're just simply going to be an OEM. You're not going to be the end user. So mm-hmm. just like when you produce another type of, I don't know, consumer goods, you want to make sure that it is dummy proof, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
hot beverages are hot.
Correct. Yeah. In the same way, you want to make sure that you want to make it in a more robust way.
Mm-hmm.
What they realize is, especially when it comes to small drones, people are just not going to bother, right? And they're just not going to spend the resources or time. And most, you know, amateur, semi-pro are not going to do that. And I'm not sure what the reason is, but I think my theory is that because they didn't want to really completely stop the industry from happening, they took a more rational approach by saying, okay, we will evaluate what is it exactly you want to do. Because again, in the previous world, you create an airplane and then you think of all the different uses. Yes, it may carry passengers. Maybe it can carry cargo. Maybe you can do some modifications and it can do surveillance. Maybe, maybe you can do heavy modifications and then it can dump, you know, water or chemicals on forest fires, right? Mm. There's a ton of things that you can do with it. So the question the regulators now have is, what are you going to do? So if you have a very specific mission profile, like we do, we're mm-hmm. only going to do cargo, one thing, cargo between airports. That's it. Nothing else. Then it becomes much easier for them to evaluate the actual risk that we create into okay. the system, that we introduce into the system. And therefore, it allows them to set the bar at a different level.
Mm-hmm. Right?
But because this is driven by who is the operator and how are you operating, that's why it's super beneficial to do what we did, which is to not just be an OEM that will find some other guy to operate, but to actually be the operator.
Yeah.
And again, our thesis played out in a very nice way. Yeah, I think others are only now kind of realizing the impact of that. Now, that's not to say that everyone around the world will adopt the same thing. We believe most of the world will adopt the same thing, but there's still regulators who have a different view, who prefer the type certification process and so on.
Yeah.
Luckily, the world is a big place and there's a ton of markets that favor this. And yeah, that's where we have the most traction.
I wonder also how hard it was for you to find the right people who jump on board with you and the company and help you build that, because you obviously didn't do it, the two of you.
No.
There is an amazing team behind it. And just like you would receive 700 no's from investors, I'm sure that, you know, there were also many people who are having the skills, mechanical engineers and software engineers, and who also wouldn't believe that exactly the two of you can actually realize that in the world.
Yeah.
Tell me about this issue. How did you tackle that?
Well, it's a market, like with investors, like with customers. Sure. It's a market.
Mm-hmm.
You optimize for those that you that resonate well with the mission, right? But also you see if you can tweak your path in a way that doesn't make you irrelevant to the fundamentals with which you've embarked on, but still in a better way to respond to that market.
Mm-hmm.
So we started in 2014. We had a choice. My brother was still in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
He had finished studying at the University of Delft, the Technical University there, and had started working for an aerospace manufacturing company. So when we had the idea, I was already in Bulgaria, but I had studied in the US. So it's fairly easy to go back there and see if we can raise capital there and so on and so forth. At the time, we, as convinced as we are in, you know, the fundamentals, we also, you know, this hunger for knowledge means that you need to recognize that if there's a lot of knowledge you haven't acquired, that means you're not super smart yet, right? So.
Do you ever come to the conclusion that you are? I think the more you know that you don't know.
Correct.
So.
Correct. I think a rational person, that's what they would adopt.
Yeah. View.
But anyway, so as a result, we knew that, yeah, we have very solid core understanding for very, you know, key things.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of gaps and help that we needed along the way. So at the time, you know, it was already popular to have startup accelerators, right? I had friends who had applied previously to Y Combinator, so I was familiar with that and so on. You know, some of the best YC companies are from, you know, 2010, 2011, like Dropbox, Airbnb and so on. They were already, you know, I was already a user of those companies, so I knew the value that YC could bring.
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, YC, their deal would be 25K for, I think, 7%, 8%, something like that. And you move there and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the same deal that 11 here in Bulgaria would have given us.
Yeah, but it was actually one of the first accelerators back then. It was a relatively new concept.
Exactly. I think it was 11 and LaunchCap had just launched. Like, they had, actually, we were batch number 7, but they did them quite quickly.
Yeah.
So I think 11 was just 2 years old. And I already had friends who had gone through 11 as well, including some of those that had been through the YC process before.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's a nice comparison.
Yeah.
Cool.
And then my brother's university at the time also had an accelerator that had the exact same deal, 25K and so on. I think they all said, okay, that's market, right?
Mm-hmm.
So both the US and the Netherlands are extremely expensive places to build.
Sure.
We're not programmers. We're not coding in a bedroom. That's not how you build airplanes. So you're going to have a lot of expenditure that's not just cost of living. So you want to be in a place where you have very low cost of life. right? And it was natural to then say, okay, let's just apply to 11, see if it works out, because we never even applied to LaunchCrypt because they were very digital focused. But 11 was a generalist, and so Constantine came back, we applied, we got in, and that's how we started.
Now, of course, you also wanted to be in a place where you have this famous white cheese. Actually, I was also very touched by the story when you had your first flight with a prototype, that actually inside there was also a kilogram of cheese, right? So that's a romantic story of how you build it, which is spreading through. I actually love the consistency of your storytelling so far. Big admiration for that.
It helps when it's the truth, right? It's the same. But yeah. So we knew, however, the trade-off we're going to face by starting in Bulgaria would be that if you were to draw a Venn diagram of where are the customers, where are the investors for this kind of thing, where's the supply chain for aerospace, and where's the talent pool for aerospace, Bulgaria barely touches that, right? So it was a very contrarian bet. But we felt like, okay, let's just start here. Let's learn, let's iterate. It's a wonderful place to iterate and to accumulate learnings and so on. We made it happen. We realized that actually this became a really strong filter for talent, right? Because the people who would join a company like this really want to be part of it, right? Because there's not a lot of talent in Bulgaria. A lot of it, because there's no other, like, there's MRO at the airport, like maintenance and so on. But what else? There's nobody's building airplanes in Bulgaria, right?
No, they're partially repairing them here.
Yeah.
So
if you want to go, and if you're a young person or an experienced person and you want to design a new aircraft, you're just simply more likely not employed in Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. You may be Bulgarian, but you're just one of the 2 million that are living abroad and so on. So we did have the talent was based either on folks who are just fresh out of university in Bulgaria, which is also a great source of talent because they're still not yet like set in their ways and so on. Because we are disrupting certain things. We are asking too many why questions about how things are typically done. And then the other part would be typically folks who have studied or lived abroad and just found a reason to come back. That reason may or may not be us. But you've seen it with a lot of people a lot of Bulgarians who live abroad. There comes a moment in their life that they tend to come back, even if it ends up being temporary. But so it's it was not easy to build that, to build the team. And the team did go through a number of evolutions. It's still going through evolutions. It's also part of how the company has progressed. You know, what worked in, you know, 5 people, 8 people garage environment doesn't work in 150 people company anymore the same way. Not everyone responds well to that journey and so on, but that's the so-called growing pains of any company, no matter what industry they're in or what location. So we're at a place where we're really, really happy with the team, and exactly like you said, without them none of this would have happened. Right now maybe two-thirds to three-quarters of the company are in Bulgaria. More than 100 people, 100 to 120 are here in Bulgaria. Mostly R&D, so engineering, aerospace engineers, mechanical, aerodynamics and avionics and so on. So all kinds of engineering roles, as well as manufacturing, prototyping, production roles. We learned to build pretty much everything ourselves. So when you visit our facility, we've built our own ovens, we've built our own equipment, machinery, pretty much because we didn't have the money to buy the proper one throughout the years, right? So we had to learn, when you don't have money, your time is cheap. When you have money, your time becomes very expensive. So you get to see things where some installations are really DIY and then others are brand new, because those are both in times when in the good times. Yeah, anyway, but so all those learnings were super helpful, because when you join, you don't just learn to do one thing, you learn to do many, many things. Mm-hmm. And that's quite exciting. We had some candidates, brilliant candidates, right? From the industry, let's say somebody who spent, what did you do at Airbus? Well, I spent like 2 years designing a hinge on the door. It's a wonderful hinge. It's why airplanes are super safe. But that person has a choice to spend 2 years of their life designing that hinge, or in two years, they can learn so much in an environment like ours or pretty much any other startup. So what carried us as well was this general, you know, boom market for startups over the past years, because so many people, and not just in aerospace but other industries, saw that there's tremendous opportunities for innovation that can happen outside of the huge companies, and tremendous opportunities for their own learning and development. Mm. So we're very happy where we are. There's always more that we can do, but yeah, that's valid for anyone.
I still have a couple of questions, but first I'm going to ask you what's coming ahead. So you just recently did another fundraising round. Before that, you have closed also a joint, it's a bit complicated, with the 40 million round that was a joint venture, or how are you going to move forward?
Sure.
Tell me about the model here, because I also understand from one of your colleagues that it's a bit more, it's much more complicated than actually in a normal, I don't know, company, right? That you have to do all these joint ventures in the separate countries in order to operate locally, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So because we're so adamant about our operator model, mm-hmm. We need to have joint ventures in every country that we operate outside of the EU. Why? Because of aviation regulations. Okay. So the reason why you don't have an American airline flying between Frankfurt and Sofia, part of the reason is because the EU has 51% ownership requirement for airlines that do domestic flights within the EU. Mm-hmm. In the US, it's 75%. So that's why Lufthansa doesn't fly between, you know, domestic routes in the US. That's why airline alliances exist, right? You mm-hmm. go with Lufthansa to one point and then you continue on United, for example, and vice versa. Now, these have existed for decades. They don't care how big, you know, how political, how strong economically you are. They just exist. They're there. Everyone complies with them. To be honest, even if they didn't exist, we would still want to enter new markets with local partners, mm-hmm. just because they are the, again, men in the arena. They are the folks out there who are who can guide us how this could help in the most efficient way, mm-hmm. right? So essentially our model is to, when we go into a new market, to find a very strong local partner. They become an investor, but they also become our local joint venture partner for that mm-hmm. territory, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And this helps us solve the ownership and control issue. But it also helps us, you know, find the right partner to unlock a particular market. Right? So we have to date, we've raised 40 something million, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not come in one big bag at the beginning, right? We started 25K. It
never does.
Exactly. With when we won Pioneers in 2015, mm-hmm. Speed Invest joined. So that was another yes. 100K check. 100K. And yeah. 11 increased their allocation and so on. Mm-hmm. So it was a curve. And I think in the first 6 or 7 years of operation, we only had raised around 3 million cumulatively. Again, we're...
did all that with 3 million.
Yeah, we had still done a lot, but
okay.
It is, yeah. That's what I mean. Like we learned to be welders, we learned to be carpenters, we learned to do a lot of things ourselves and so on. So now, and then in 2020, 2021, you know, the pandemic really gave us a boost because people really saw that, okay, there's these airplanes going to other countries, but the pilots, the crews get quarantined for like 7 days, 14 days, they can't come back. What do we do? And so it was a no-brainer that, well, if the pilots never leave, you know, you can much easier just like shuttle goods back and forth. People realize how important supply chains can be to their lives and so on and so forth. So a lot more people had this aha moment that we had as well. So we got a lot of traction again, like with angel investors. We had hundreds and hundreds of angel investors to date. We even listed a safe note on the Bulgarian Stock Exchange. Again, in a way, we've always been about the same way we want to democratize same day delivery. In the same way, we wanted to kind of democratize access to, you know, to opportunities for people. So we're big fans of crowdfunding and that. So we are at the end of last year, we received investment from a sovereign wealth fund from Abu Dhabi. Mm-hmm. They specialize in frontier tech. It's called SDF, the Strategic Development Fund.
Yeah.
And you know they're not afraid of hardware. In fact, I don't think they like things that are just software. I think they purposely go out and seek hardware.
That's
because
a good tip for everyone who is actually doing hardware, because I think they're having hard trouble in the US and in Europe.
Yeah, and and they're great guys and so on, and okay. really smart and very very good fit. So anyway, so again, the investment game is investment, but also understanding that there will be the joint venture partner. So there's a lot more we'll be able to announce towards the end of the year, but that's our funding path. And then after the first flight that we had now in May, after that we just had a lot of those angels, a lot of those existing investors, they come out and say, hey, this amazing it's a great milestone, can we increase our allocation and so on. So we decided to create a structure where we allow for that to happen, and you know, we open it to existing investors, and one of the existing investors is Seedblink, you know, the Romania originated European crowdfunding platform. We've just closed a very successful campaign with them, and it's again giving access to people to an opportunity. They get to decide for themselves and so on, but given that now we have validated so much more. The first flight was non-trivial at all. There's a long list of things that we were able to validate by virtue of just seeing that this aircraft flies. Mm-hmm. We were confident that it will, but to see that validation was really tremendous. So,
and also to ensure the rest of the world that it is working. I think this is actually the big moment. It was maybe an aha moment for you, but for everyone else who was at this point already even doubting, I think.
Yeah.
At least it's what I sensed at some point in the community, which is okay, of course.
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly. So it was essentially a validation that, you know, of that confidence that we had and that bet that we knew was the best possible bet, but we finally saw it validated. So it definitely helped a lot with credibility. And then we just recently also received our IATA and ICAO codes. So we're now essentially within the aviation framework. We're just like another airline. So we can partner with other airlines. We're working on some newsworthy moments there as well. But we'll be able to connect and interface with other airlines in a very smooth way, in the same systems, the same platforms.
How is the maintenance issue actually solved? Can it be also done by engineers who are repairing the rest of the airplanes? It's like the manned airplanes, okay?
Everything we've always done was always like a crawl, walk, run approach. So crawl phase is always, we need to do it ourselves so that we know how to teach somebody else to do it for us. Okay. So that's the model for the cargo handling. That's the model for the maintenance and so on. We will definitely rely on people who already have expertise and are, you know, the certified maintenance providers, cargo handling providers and so on. But we'll still be in the initial operations very involved ourselves as well, so that we can, again, that learning, that tweaking, we get that feedback instantly so that we can also incorporate some changes if there's changes that need to be made, right? Okay. Because otherwise that learning accumulates to, you know, pockets here and there and so on. And it may take you a long time to hear from that feedback, and then it just extends the cycle unnecessarily.
I'm thinking also that probably the end goal of democratizing the access also to the opportunity of, you know, developing Dynamics and growing Dynamics would be an IPO. Where do you see that?
Yeah, no, exactly. So
in the future,
my brother and I personally have, you know, this is our life's work, right? So we've never built this for a quick exit, a quick acquisition and so on. We want to turn it into a generational company, you know, that will make, you know, tremendous amount of positive impacts for everyone everywhere, right? And so we have a vision that is on an extremely long timeline. We know that not everyone has that.
Have you written it down somewhere?
We don't need to, to be honest. We don't need to kind of remind ourselves that it's what we have, what we carry. So, but as a result, we know that not everyone can operate on such long timelines. And we will, our plan is to finish the flight test program towards the end of the year, start commercial operations end of this year or the beginning of next. And then after a few years of, you know, successful operations, revenue generation, proof of profitability and so on, to get to a stage where we would be listing on a stock market, so that we have that liquidity event for a lot of the stakeholders that may not want to stay forever with us the way that we want to stay forever with it. So IPO is definitely the goal.
Well, you mentioned something in the beginning and I want to refer to that. You said that the harder it is, the more rewarding it would be. Thinking of a generational company, I wonder, where is the moment where in your life, but maybe that you see maybe in the life of your kid, because you're also a father, where you say, okay, this is why we built it. This is the moment where that we wanted to achieve. Is there some kind of like an end vision? I'm not so sure. Or a place where you would just sit somewhere in a fireside place with a whiskey and say, hey, yeah, we made it.
So the current projections for what the world would look like in the year 2100, so end of this century, means essentially the projections are that the world will have around 11 billion people on the planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
But with demographic trends in developed societies, most of those will decrease in population,
yeah.
Right? Some of them have started. And so 90% of the growth from where we are to where we are, where we will be at the end of the century, according to those projections.
Will come from developing countries, right?
90% will come from Africa.
Africa in particular. Wow.
Yeah. So it's the, you know, second largest continent by land area.
Yeah.
The world's first 100 million city will be Lagos in Nigeria,
mm-hmm.
according to those projections again. There will be others that will be 100 million people. So the world will look like a completely different place from where it is now. I think people don't, again, if you're very focused on the very short term, it's natural to not think about mm-hmm. that. Then there's, you know, potential climate impact. We can spend time talking about it. But the fact of the matter is we've built an enormous amount of ground infrastructure, good roads and so on in geographies where very small. Europe is one of the smallest continents, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
US has plenty of roads and so on, but it's a fraction of the land mass and, you know, population that will be back, over then. And Asia is amazing, but it does have, you know, some of the most populous nations over there are, you know, living on thousands of islands and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be so much opportunity for flying because there will be little other way.
Mm-hmm.
Even today, the cost of a road in Africa is, you know, more than $1 million per lane to build 1 kilometer, even there, right?
Wow.
Okay. And this is not necessarily, you know, I don't think people have an answer of how this can go down. So
it will be much cheaper also to fly people, goods.
Because of the distances, right?
Okay.
Because it's not just also whether you have the road, but do you want to spend those additional hours because the distance is huge, right?
Of course.
What is the comfort going to be, or and so on and so forth. So we see that there is no other way than just to, you know, completely rationalize how you fly and be in those markets. So this, the people that solve this part will have made a tremendous impact on how the world will have evolved until mm-hmm. then, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah, that's the vision that we have, you know, when we're very, very old and, you know, 120 years old and so on, is that we've played a part of, you know, making this happen, making this be easier on folks and be, I got asked the other day about, you know, people that I admire the most, like as entrepreneurs and so on. The folks that we admire are, you know, folks like Henry Ford, like the founder of IKEA, the founder of Zara, and so on. Folks who have leveraged logistics. Because logistics or manufacturing or innovation are the underlying, you know, value generator for businesses like that, or what made them into the giants that they are, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also because they, in the process of doing so, they created a much lower price point for the products that they were creating. You know, before the Model T, cars were extremely out of reach for, you know, the regular person. Furniture, clothing, and so on. Now, it was those folks that, by virtue of focusing on these, the boring stuff, the logistics, the details, the supply chain, and so on, they were able to create a situation where you can actually give access to a much better quality of life to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so, again, when you think about that vision, there's going to be a lot more consumers in the world and so on, but they're not always going to be the ones with the highest purchasing power. So, again, that that infrastructure build out, that's really what's super exciting to me, to my brother, to the company, because when we play a role in that, it's not just you know, solving a problem, you're actually helping people have a better life materially.
Another thing that I find a bit extraordinary about you, and I think this is a common critique that we hear mostly by investors here in our region, is that founders are not ambitious enough in Central and Eastern Europe. I think in your case, probably you've heard the opposite, that you're too ambitious. I don't know how many times you heard that implied. And still, if you would have now, you know, also here the stage and this podcast to speak to founders who can be much more ambitious than they are, that who can actually overcome this glass ceiling, which is actually just a figment of their imagination, what would you tell them?
Yeah, so we've been very down to earth and rational about certain things, but very ambitious for the other things, mm-hmm. right? So one could say we're not ambitious enough because we didn't decide to have, you know, some crazy vertical takeoff, hypersonic, whatever, as aircraft number one, right? Mm-hmm. We decided to have a more pragmatic fixed wing with an existing engine that's already certified and so on and so forth. So crawl, walk, run, to some people doesn't sound like ambitious, right? Okay. But I do believe, yes, you have to find the right balance of what you need to be pragmatic about and what you need to be super, super firm and relentlessly ambitious about. Mm-hmm. A long timeline helps on that. Okay. Because it allows you to do both.
Okay.
To tell yourself the story that you have the time to run, but it has to come after crawling and walking first, right? Mm-hmm. But the overarching advice is I'm very biased and I don't expect people have different risk profiles. Not everyone should be a founder, in my opinion. Yeah. I mean, everyone should try who wants. But if it's not successful, they should not think less of themselves. And so on. We're all different, right? So, but what I've learned about me and, you know, my brother, what we know about ourselves, and is that we've decided to believe more, to be more in the camp of if you shoot for the moon, you still end up in the star, among the stars, mm. right? Mm. And that you have one life only. So, you know, for us, it's more exciting to make it more ambitious. Again, go after the harder thing. To mm-hmm. us, to create something super niche, super bespoke, super expensive, it's not as exciting, right? Mm-hmm. It feels silly. We're now in a in a cinema, but I used to play the guitar. We yeah. even had like a high school band. Anyway, teenagehood, but even back then, I realized, hey, we can create songs, but and we can do something really niche that's like only five people in the world like, right? And there's mm-hmm. there's a theory and thesis for that, and there's some artists who choose that, right? Who seek out this. But to me, that's not interesting, because then how do I get the validation that what I'm doing is right? Right? Okay. You give too much power to five people. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a lot more valuable that if I create a song that, you know, is the summer song, it's top of the charts, it's in everyone's head, it transcends nationalities, you know, cultures, age groups and so on. So to me, you know, back then our bandmates, like some of them, they were like, oh, well, we like this style, but those other styles, popular music, it sucks and blah, 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 blah. To me, actually, it was not like that. I felt a lot of respect for popular music. Yes, there's a lot of marketing that helps make it happen, makes those songs win the charts. But you know, there can be only one at the top, and they must have done a lot of things right to be there and to have touched, you know, millions and hundreds of millions of people around the world in a similar, in the same way to create that. I think that's very rare. That's very difficult to do. And I respect the work that gets into doing that. So, and it's true validation. It's indisputable, right?
Yeah.
It's disputable if you five guys like you. It's indisputable if, you know, everyone likes that song. Right? So that was, again, my impression, you know, my view of the world is this, or at least my choice for my life. That's not to say that I don't respect the work of the niche and, you know, the... you know, the ambition that goes into creating something outstanding, even if it's very rare and so on. It's just the, by way of our upbringing that we've been very grateful for folks out there who have, you know, again, made fashion products more accessible to, you know, a family that couldn't afford otherwise. You know, furniture more accessible and things like that. So, so to me, that's the bond I'd like to be in.
We're totally out of time, but still, I feel like I must ask you, what were you ready to sacrifice along the way? Because I'm sure that it's, you know, it's not all roses.
Well, ego.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
You hear 700 rejections, and I mean that was before the pandemic. Now you know the rate is lower, but there's still a lot of not there yet, not now, come back when, and so on. There's still that. It's definitely gotten a lot easier, but you have to learn that rejection again is not a statement on you. It's actually more of a statement on the other person's perception on the world. Yeah. And yeah, and of course, you know, time, like you only have one life, so you better be super, super certain that's what you want to do. And so we don't necessarily view it as a sacrifice.
But it has an alternative cost. I mean, in this, in the meantime, you could have done so many other things, which, I don't know, whatever, could provide you with different things. Well,
it really helps that... what we do gives us extreme pleasure, right? So,
yeah.
And of course, the things we never sacrifice on our family, but that's due to our upbringing, right? We grew up, again, in the home of a teacher and a journalist. They weren't exactly the most well-remunerated roles in post-communist Bulgaria. So you know, we're raised in the same room and blah, 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 blah. Many people have had similar journeys, so it's not about the thing. But the point is that family is super important for us. So that's where we draw the line. But everything else is, you know, secondary to work.
Well, here I want to thank you for what you've done also for our ecosystem, because I think it totally makes a difference if you do a popular song somewhere from the States or from Sweden. It's another thing if you can actually make it from Bulgaria and you make the whole world think, what? Bulgaria? So I think you're also one of those companies who are going to be emblematic long time in the future.
We hope so.
I hope so too. It definitely is now. And you're going to pave the way for many other entrepreneurs and inventors to follow. So from my side, thank you.
No, thank you. And look, I think that's part of the beauty of the startup, you know, ecosystem, not just in Bulgaria, but elsewhere as well. It's the more people start taking risks, you know, career risks like that. And the more they... you know, the bigger pool of those is out there, the more successes there will be out there. And then success breeds success. So there will be, I think, young people, when they think about like what path to choose in their life, in their career, they'll have a lot more confirmation that, you know, this is a viable path to not just seek out like join a big corporation and so on, climb the ladder there. That's also a valid path and so on, but there are other ones, because for a long time, this other path didn't really exist. Yeah. It existed in the US, right? But, and that's why it works there so well, because it's, you know, Silicon Valley is, you know, so many decades older than Europe or other places. People have had the time to see, oh, this person was a founder, or even this person was employee number 8, number 800, and they cashed out when there was, so they bought a house, they bought something. So maybe that's actually a great path to explore. So you see it a lot more in the States because they've had more time to develop and to develop those successes. And I'm very positive about this happening in Europe. You already see it, like successful startups, their exits and so on generate more successful startups.
That's why we call it also the recursive, because it is a recursion. We build up. I was just thinking, you know, exactly. Some time ahead, how, in a way, also the communist regime basically, you know, cut, you know, this entrepreneurial generation that was developing back then. And what could have happened if we didn't have communism in between? Because already back then we had amazing entrepreneurs who were also ready to give back so much to society.
We also had an aviation industry. We had 3 factories which had produced 1,000 airplanes and okay. had developed 40 different designs. So a lot of things would have looked differently, but that's the past. We can't change it. What we can change is the future. And that's, I guess, the message. It's like people shouldn't be afraid to go off the beaten path and explore and experiment. I'm not saying everyone should have a generational view on everything they start, but they should definitely try to recalibrate their perception of what risk looks like, because there's so much, the world has changed so dramatically in terms of technology and risk profile. The financial crisis of 08, 09, you know, it caused huge generational companies, household names, to go out of business. That was a huge signal for, not just for me, but should have been a huge signal for everyone, that old thing that, like, your parents may say, oh, get a job in a good, stable company, it's job security. There is no job security. The job security only lasts until the next quarter's results in any company around the world. Like, it's just how it is, right? So I think people in future generations, and they're going to have to think more and more about that, because when you consider how the pension systems are constructed, they were done at a different time with different, not just Bulgaria, but pretty much everywhere.
Demographic structures, actually.
Yeah. And we're light years away from the time when they used to, like, those systems, the math worked out. And that's why, I don't know, people our generation, I would not be surprised that by the time we retire, we need to be 80 years old, right? Like, or 85, right? And then the generations that are coming out of college now, maybe 90. Advances in medicine certainly help, but, like, it's one thing to have 30-year career, it's another thing to have a 50-year career and 60-year career, yeah. and so on, right?
Yeah.
It's a different journey. So to me, what I'm doing actually feels as the safer bet, right?
if you put it this way, that makes sense, yeah. At least you're somehow in control of how the company is going to develop, and you're betting on things that are going to be valid in 30 years from now, probably.
And that's why I feel, you know, we have an option pool, and, you know, the companies own it and so on. That's also something not super common in Bulgaria, but we want to have everyone to share in the success. We have, and that's why I was really, you know, the big champion for that to happen, to list that safe note on the stock exchange, to use that EU regulation that allows to do that, and kudos to the EU for actually enabling that to happen, and crowdfunding and so on. People need to kind of take ownership of their, you know, financial future, and part of that is, you know, make it their own sound financial decisions, of course.
Yeah. And those may be creating value because this is the safest path of.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
It may not apply for everyone, and there's a lot of value, and these companies exist for a reason and have been successful. But the world has advanced quite a bit since some of those, you know, proverbs were created.
Like, yeah, true. Well, I could ask you so much more now that we started on these topics, but I'm pretty sure that I'll have to let you go because...
No, that's all right.
Yeah, I'm sure that you're also very busy. Let's see. What time should we sit again and check on how far did you go? In 5 years?
Hopefully sooner. But yeah.
Hopefully sooner. In any case, thank you for this conversation and also letting us, see a bit more of how, you know, thoughts are created in your head and how they move around and how they create realities and they manifest. It's been amazing what you've done so far.
Thank you. No, thank you. It's a pleasure.
And if you're just as passionate about innovation as we are, hit subscribe for the Recursive Podcast on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. We're everywhere.